You and I were talking about when I saw you last that, we've crunched the numbers. We have 40 plus years of data on the correlation between real estate, stocks, and gold. And stocks, as well as bonds, are positively correlated with real estate going back to 1972. Gold is inversely correlated to both of those asset classes. So I just can't comprehend not having an allocation in one's portfolio that is defensive at this time and inversely correlated in light of what we're seeing.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Drew Mason, welcome to the show.
Praise be Jesus who sends his wisdom. Thank you so much for inviting me, Sam. And a hello to all the great volunteers in your home state there.
Hey, thank you so much. Certainly appreciate that. Drew, tell us just real quickly, where are you based out of and what has been the highlight of your day?
Well, I'm based out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and this is a highlight, Sam, for sure. I've been looking forward to reconnecting with you since I saw you, and I'm very pleased to have the chance to share with your subscribers and talk a little bit about how we may be able to complement some of the things that real estate investors are seeing based on the real estate investors that are coming to us in our business here in 2021.
Well, I appreciate that. And, we keep things kind of light, but serious at the same time here on this show. I think if this is your highlight, maybe I'm going to work on your highlights there, Drew, and maybe we can increase what your highlights might be in the future. So, hey, man, thank you so much again for coming on. This will be a blast. I'm looking forward to it. Tell us, just real quickly, can you give our listeners a bio on who you are? And I ask these same questions to everybody. Where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there? But if you can tell us that in the most succinct format possible, like maybe 90 seconds or less.
Business education commenced at Wharton, graduated from there, started a company out of the gates myself. And it was a complete failure. I was absolutely devastated that I had had such a great upbringing and education, and I totally blew it. Then I realized, based on my own dad's experience, unless I let that failure become something, it's nothing but a stepping stone for me. I ended up writing a book about failure and overcoming it, hoping to inspire people who had some really difficult setbacks. While I was doing that, I ended up writing what's called soft dollar research, and I cleared it through old firms like Smith Barney and Payne Weber. And then that led me to a position with the old Payne Weber. I worked on Wall Street for a little over 15 years. And it culminated in 2008 when, the honest way to describe it is I was just too weak as an individual to get out of Lehman Brothers when we knew there was a problem. And as a result, I was there in September of 2008. And it was super painful, incredibly painful, but it was also a blessing and an incredible learning experience because I think what was happening to us at Lehman was a microcosm of America and that we were closing our eyes to the debts and all the problems that were clearly going to come back and bite us. And it did. And that was what led me to get into gold as a career. And I have been full-time in gold really ever since, using it to help people diversify their wealth and protect their wealth today.
That's really interesting. And I didn't know that part of your story was that you were in with Lehman Brothers up until September of 2008. Before we get into really, because we focus on a couple of things in this show. One is the softer skills. And I think you've touched on something. I'd like to hear this side of your story before we get into the gold side of the story, which I'm sure both of these have their own intrinsic pieces of it that will be gold. But you said you didn't have what did you say that you lacked in order to get out of Lehman Brothers when you saw the writing on the wall?
Well, really just intestinal fortitude, right? I had conversations with senior management in early 2008 and said, hey, I really am worried about this balance sheet. And I think it's kind of concerning. And they, looked me in the eye and said, you sissy, get back to your desk. We have the number one equity franchise in the street. We have the number one fixed income franchise in the street. We just saw JP Morgan buy Bear Stearns for $10 a share. What do you think is going to happen to us here at Lehman Brothers? We're 100 years old. So what do I know? And what was happening, Sam, is that they paid us half our comp almost in company stock. And if you left, you forfeited that. So everybody wants to hope, right? Everybody's hoping for, a better tomorrow. And so, especially with those gold handcuffs, we were certainly hoping. But really, you could have been a 10-year-old with a 1-hour course on reading balance sheets. You would have known there was going to be a problem at some point for Lehman Brothers. And so what I, you know, rather than moving on and doing something hard, we stayed there to the end with, you know, thousands of others. But again, I feel like that was such a blessing, because today I see the same thing with American investors, right? Like, we have record leverage, we have record speculation as measured by futures and leveraged ETFs. Everybody's just hoping good things are going to continue, hoping. And I feel like, especially as you get older and there's more, you know, history than runway perhaps in your career, and you have to start thinking about, well, what if I don't have another 20 years of Fed liquidity to rebuild, when I have my personal wealth situated in a way that I can sleep well at night and know that if something happens to me, that I've positioned very well for what's next.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point you bring up there, is on the hoping for a better tomorrow, even in the face of data that really, you know, data doesn't hope. It's just, it is what it is. And what you interpret it is what, you know, how you interpret it's what matters. You know, the data has no hope whatsoever. So I think it's interesting to say that we hope, even though the data may be saying there's a problem here.
Right. So let's talk about the data, though, and what's happening. So I would submit to your investors, and by the way, I want to tip my hat to all of your participants who are involved in commercial real estate, which has been a great sector to be in. You've probably, you've done very well. You've made a wise capital allocation. You've hopefully prospered from it. And I commend you on your sage decision to focus there. But if we step back and you think about all of your basics in real estate, right, whether it's CAPM, you know, you look at the cap rates and you look at the formulas and how you come up with fair value. If you look at it, there's no input into fair valuing real estate that's based on government spending, right? Why? Because once you introduce the government spending, you don't have fair free markets. Then you have this distortion. And as government spending becomes a dominant animal, then the distortions get bigger. And I would say to all your listeners, I think an important question is, why do we have QE? And the answer is simply, government didn't want free markets, bonds, stocks, and real estate to price where they naturally would. And so they're injecting record amounts of money to prop those markets up. And that means people who are buying in are buying at artificially high levels. And we hope it's going to continue, right? I mean, I'm surprised, honestly, the Fed's been able to keep this going, and investors have been so disinterested in risk management and risk diversification. Maybe they can get another 10 years out of it, which would be fine if they can. But without a doubt, people really need to understand that, you know, we are seeing distortions we've never seen. We have 5,000 years of financial data, right? Now, obviously, there's not a daily close going back 3,000 years in China. But if you look at some of the things that have been put out by, whether it's Bank of England or some of the Wall Street investment banks, we literally have this multi-millennial data set. We've never had negative rates on a nominal basis. We're talking about not even real, on a nominal basis. So it's highlighting for you how extraordinary this pricing is. And I think the most important consideration for us recognizing that is portfolio construction, right? Do you really want to have all of your eggs in a basket that's benefiting from this unnatural liquidity? Because I think a lot of people, when we have conversations with family offices, you know, they say, hey, I'm diversified. I have 10 different stocks. Well, if we have a severe market correction, 85% of them are stocks go lower. And we see through the data, you and I were talking about when I saw you last, that, you know, we've crunched the numbers. We have 40 plus years of data on the correlation between real estate, stocks, and gold. And stocks, as well as bonds, are positively correlated with real estate going back to 1972. Gold is inversely correlated to both of those asset classes. So I just can't comprehend not having an allocation in one's portfolio that is defensive at this time and inversely correlated in light of what we're seeing.
That's really interesting. And I don't disagree with you, right? I own plenty of precious metals myself. So I don't disagree. One, just because I love being able to touch and hold, which is why I love real estate as well, right? I love being able to go out and knock on the building and be like, oh yeah, like that's, you're real. I can touch you. I see you. And the same thing, of course, with precious metals. But talk to us about, I want to rewind that thought a little bit when you're talking about the mispricing in the market and these injections of liquidity. Yes, I wouldn't argue with you that they're certainly mispricing, but I wonder, and the question that we've often, you know, tossed around on this show is, even if there is a mispricing, have we just repriced it such that now there's so much liquidity that what used to be $1 million asset is now, based upon liquidity and, you know, slash inflation, now it's a $2 million asset, and it's never going back to that $1 million mark because we've devalued our currency. So have we really moved any, or is it still just the same asset worth approximately the same value relative to how much money there is in the economy?
Well, that's a good point. And what I am very cognizant of, Sam, is I'm not the smartest bulb on the shelf. So what I take great comfort in is high probabilities. And when I can look at data going, you know, back literally to ancient Greece, if all that was needed to save an economy was to print money, ancient Greece and ancient Rome would still be standing along with Weimar and, you know, countless of other nations. Sure. So the idea that this is just painless is unsubstantiated in history, right? So what you are articulating is completely supported by history. And that is we're talking about the compression of value in our currency because of the proliferation of supply of money that isn't backed by anything. Right. So this is not something that we have to theorize about how's it going to turn out. We got 500 case studies. And again, when 500 out of 500 come out the same way, I like my odds and I think, hey, I want some exposure here. So what gold is different, like what we see real estate investors coming to us and they appreciate the liquidity of gold. And what I would say to you is what gold is money that can't be destroyed by a central banker or a government policy mistake. And on that latter point, that's a great difference between real estate and any other assets and gold. So that when, as we compress the value of dollars, yes, real estate and dollars probably will grow, but we're coming from a baseline where, because gold is inversely correlated to real estate and equities, I would submit to you that it is artificially cheap here. And, you know, you can see that by who's interested in the metals right now. No one. Everyone's chasing, you know, the higher returning assets for good reason, right? They're working, understandably. Having a 0% allocation in this recognition, I don't think is prudent or wise looking forward, because there's not another asset I'm aware of today, maybe ever in our lifetimes, where we can essentially say the government is subsidizing our purchase of this investment of gold by QE making it less expensive than where it would trade if there were not subsidies today, versus if I buy equities, I'm buying at a price that is, again, elevated from where it likely would be if the government wasn't in there spending as they're spending.
I've got a couple of questions. You mentioned a term that I don't typically hear go hand in hand. You said gold and liquidity of gold. Walk us through that.
Well, real estate certainly feels very liquid now, but, you know, we know every asset is unique and it's not instantaneous, right? Gold trades more in average daily value than the Dow Jones. So Americans don't appreciate, you know, how significant this asset class is. It trades 23 hours a day, 5 days a week. There's liquidity on the weekends. So if someone wants to convert their gold into dollars or euro or yen, there is a deep, deep market for it that's readily available. And so let me say, I hope that I am not a gold bug, right? A gold bug is someone who buys gold and they die with it. I think this is a moment to be a gold bull. We're looking at this as an asset that's undervalued, underappreciated, underowned. And then when it is appropriately repriced, then it will likely come at a time when other assets are marked down, and I will have the liquidity to step in and buy whatever else we want to buy as the next cycle begins to unfold. Gold is not about Armageddon, right? I mean, we've gone through multiple currencies in this country already, through all the nations. We've never had Armageddon. Gold is about wealth insurance, and I really believe helping families position themselves to capitalize on the opportunities of tomorrow that the premier liquidity source in history can afford them.
That's interesting that you call it wealth insurance as opposed to the Armageddon, you know, potential to trade with gold or barter with gold or silver or any other precious metal. One of the things we're hearing right now is that in Venezuela, they have gone back to buying and selling things based on gold. How do you compare that with what you just said a minute ago?
I think there's a great disservice being done to investors and family offices when their financial advisors frame gold in the context of Armageddon, right? Again, because we've seen this time and time again. I'm amazed how many sophisticated investors don't realize that the founders of this great nation insisted that the only money in the country would be physical gold, physical silver. Obviously, we got away from that. The founders said that was treason. And the reason for wanting it was to protect people from seeing the value of their currencies obliterated, which is what has happened every time a government hasn't backed its currency by something. So I think it is as simple as saying, you know, it's a little bit like insurance for your home, right? You don't want the fire to come, but there's a chance it will. Now, in the case of gold, I would say, however, the probabilities are almost 100% that it's going to increase in value. There isn't any guarantee with gold, right? I don't use that term insurance literally, but in some ways it has something better than a de facto guarantee that people are limited to deliver on. Gold has this precedent. When there is stress on other assets, gold thrives. And that value in composing and constructing a portfolio is very significant and has afforded people great opportunities. And you and I were talking when we were together, I think last too, Sam, about, say, the example of JP Morgan. He could have gotten rid of his gold, but as he saw the late 20s maturing and debts increasing, he made an allocation and held gold. And when the Depression came and there was a problem with debts, he lent his gold to the biggest buyer, to the biggest borrower, the U.S. government. And as a result, was able to craft some very attractive deals for himself. So I think that is a mentality you want to have going in. You buy gold for defense. Ironically, it has spectacular upside now, too, in my opinion. But you buy it for defense. You kind of hope with this being your hedge that, you know, you really don't need it, but we're doing it because we don't want to build our futures on hope. And because the history and the data says it's really more a question of when that we see this significant revaluation to it. And when that happens, Sam, you know, I think that is a way, like JP Morgan did, that I would say to all your listeners, you can be in a position to really dramatically scale up your businesses and your assets, because when there's a liquidity crunch, gold has historically been the greatest source of liquidity. You have the opportunity to step up and buy assets when others are hurting. It is a de facto type of promise to a portfolio that's very positive to have in one's arsenal.
Certainly, certainly. And you used the term earlier, when, which brings up the next question. On a cycle snapshot, like, where are we? Are we in the second inning? Are we in the 10th inning? Where are we in this cycle?
Great question. Because another thing I hear from financial advisors, it's too late. Gold's run a lot. Well, if gold is money, like the Constitution and the capital markets and the central banks say it is, then you really want to look at the price of gold, not in a vacuum. You want to look at it in relation to the proxies for gold, say the US dollar and the supply of money. Well, if you look at the price of gold today relative to the money supply, it's as cheap as it's been in our lifetimes. So I think we are super, super early. In my opinion, Sam, we just saw literally a generational shift. I mean that literally. Most of your listeners are probably too young to remember, but in the late 70s, early 80s, I would argue was the beginning of this investment cycle where we saw rates and inflation grind lower from the 20% level. And I would say that cycle ended in March of 2020. Thematically, what happened was in the 80s, when inflation was roaring, people thought everything's getting more expensive. I don't want any of my money. And then that ended in March of 2020 when everyone said the world's shutting down. You know, all these goods are not going to be in demand. And we saw bond yields hit their low. Now, I think we are moving in the opposite direction. And I think this, you know, this is not going to be transitory. This is going to be a very long cycle before this plays out again. And the cycle that we have lived in, I don't think we appreciate, again, how atypical it is. We've never seen before a nation that had the sole reserve currency of the world hold its balance sheet together when rates were at 18%. So for our entire investment careers, we have been with a tailwind to stocks, bonds, and real estate, whereas rates and inflation came lower, it expanded the multiples. If we are now indeed reversing, as history says it will, and coming from this level, it could be a very significant move. That is a monster tailwind for gold and a headwind for other assets. Think about in the 70s, we saw the S&P multiple cut in half. Why? Again, going back to the basic formulas, as you discount the value of those cash flows, if inflation is higher, the value of the cash flow is worth less than when inflation is lower. So I think that we are super early. Less than 1% of Americans have an allocation to gold today, which is beautiful. The largest family offices, you look at their surveys of wealth, and it's not even an asset class for them yet. We're also benefiting from this, what I think is an incredible tailwind coming together behind gold. In addition to lack of allocation is supply. The largest gold miner in the world that's publicly traded, the CEO said, if every gold project on the drawing board hits in the decade ahead, we're still going to see supply shrink by 30%. So not a whole lot for people to sell because we don't have it yet. Supply is very constrained moving forward. Inflation, which is a plus for it and a headwind for other assets, and the proxy for gold, and it's not just the dollar now, every major currency in the world is overly indebted, can't afford to pay down its debts without devaluing its currencies. So I think the combination of all those things leads me to conclude, again, the probabilities are very high here that gold will perform attractively in a portfolio and will have a positive and attractive return in this environment that we're moving to. I think the only wrong allocation to have is what most Americans do, and that's 0%. We're not buying it for Armageddon. We're buying it to position ourselves for an even better tomorrow.
I like that. Given some compelling reasons there as to why gold should be held, you know, and I think the one that really sums up everything in my mind, maybe at least, that what you've just said is that the price relative to the money supply. And, you know, without going in too deep on that, what I hear when you say that is that the price really, I mean, I think I'm going back to 2013, 2012. I mean, where were we? Maybe in the $1,500 an ounce range. And I think we're at what? In the 1800s, maybe-ish right now. But yet our money supply is what? Doubled? Tripled?
Oh, absolutely. And if you want, I can send you some charts that we have on this. But I mean, we're at a multi-decade lows here in that view, Sam. And what's very amazing, when I say gold, I'm talking precious metals, gold and silver, right? Sure. What's good for one is good for the other. But it's even more remarkable in silver. To the best of my knowledge, I welcome any listener correcting me. But when I go back to the peak of the last inflationary cycle in 1980, and I look at every tangible commodity, cotton, soybean, oil, you name it, they are all up dramatically from the prior cycle. The only element that I'm aware of that is below its 1980 level is silver. And it's 50% below where it traded in 1980. And so gold is cheap. Silver is just like a head scratcher. You would think it was a carcinogenic now, and that's why people were shunning it. But it has, you know, the most fabulous end markets you could hope for. Sells into hybrid car batteries, wind, all types of alternative energies. It is used in healthcare now because they've learned the incredible properties that the Phoenicians knew of silver and aiding in health as an anti-biocidal. Cell phones, computers, the uses of it. So it is just dirt cheap in relation to money supply. And I think the risk reward, you know, for given that reality is just very compelling.
That's fascinating. Drew, time to wrap up here. This has certainly been a blast. I've really enjoyed it. But before we do that, you said that most Americans hold 0% allocation of precious metals in their portfolio. Walk us through one or maybe two simple ways to do this without necessarily digging a hole in your backyard and covering up the ball mason jar.
Yes. So easy way to do it is to just buy some of the most well-recognized, easily tradable forms of gold that you can purchase. I would encourage you not to store it in a safety deposit box at a bank. You can just Google what's going on at banks from Beverly Hills to, you know, all across the country. I would encourage listeners to, you know, choose an insured vault outside of the financial system that doesn't lend or hypothecate its metals. And, you know, investors can buy it in their IRAs. And for what we see some real estate investors doing is just peeling off some liquidity. Some of them have, you know, heavy equity in a property. I'll just say, I'm going to buy 100,000, whatever the number is, of gold, just so I have some type of allocation to begin to think about, leg into, learn more about. And that's all there is to it. It's a very simple process.
I like that. That's a clean way to do it. Again, without, you know, storing physical assets in your backyard and dealing with that side of it, but yet still hopefully will present some of the protections that that these precious metals bring. Drew, is there any other thoughts or anything else you'd like to share with our listeners here before we sign off?
We enjoy hearing about other sectors. If there's any interest in learning more, you know, we've just scratched the surface on what it has to offer. We have a managed fund that we run, and we have a website where we have one of we have a 24-hour, 6-day-a-week trading platform. Our website is stjosephpartners.com. We write about the metals, and if you'd like to learn any more, we'd be honored to share what we've learned with you.
That's awesome. Yeah, that was going to be my last question, was the best way to get a hold of you, and it sounds like we just heard that, which is St. Joseph, that's S-T, not the word spelled out, but S-T, Joseph, J-O-S-E-P-H, partners.com. And Drew, one last question for you. You made mention of some charts and some graphs and things like that. Are those things that can be found there on your website? Can we post links to those in the show?
Some of them are, and if there's anything you'd like to see that you don't see, just let us know.
That's awesome. Drew, thank you so much again for your time today. I do appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.